Hi, it's Simon here. The Museum of the Bible opens this month in Washington, D.C., and this is going to be an extraordinary facility. The Americans tend to do museums well, and this will be no exception. And last year, we sat down with a couple of the architects of this project when they were in Sydney and had a great conversation with them. I hope you enjoy it. Hi, it's great to have your company. You're listening to Life and Faith from the Centre for Public Christianity. My name's Simon Smart.
And I'm Natasha Moore.
Well, it's the best-selling book of all time. It's had an immeasurable impact on the world, and now it's getting its own museum. The Museum of the Bible is due to be open in 2017 in the middle of Washington, D.C., just a few blocks away from the U.S. Capitol and some of the greatest museums of the world.
The Museum of the Bible is the brainchild of the Green family, who are a family of American entrepreneurs. And over the last 6 years, they've been building up this collection. They now have more than 40,000 objects. It's one of the largest private collections of biblical artifacts in the world.
And today in the studio, we've got a couple of key people, part of the Museum of the Bible, Alan Quine and David Trobisch. They'll be talking to us today. First of all, Alan, I want to ask you about some of the big picture questions about this enterprise. What is the Museum of the Bible, or what is it going to be?
Well, thanks, Simon, and thank you, Natasha, for having us here. The Museum of the Bible is not merely a Bible museum in Washington, D.C. It is that, to help people engage the Bible. It's not a denomination, it's not a church group, but it's just about the Bible. And so it covers anybody and all facets of people who love the Bible and are interested in it and engaging in it. But that's only one facet of the project. The other is an education facet to it. So we seek to educate people about the Bible beyond the box in Washington, D.C. Also an academic facet to it. And the fourth facet is traveling exhibitions, whether domestically in the States or worldwide.
You say the box in D.C. What will that specifically look like?
Yeah, it's a reconstruction of a city block, three buildings that were abutting each other. They tore down the middle building and completely refurbished the third building. It'll be 16 stories high. Each floor will be different. Three major floors are the story of the Bible. Just people don't know what the Bible's about anymore, and so we're just going to portray its story, let it speak for itself, both the Hebrew Bible and the New Testament. Another story is the impact of the Bible, really my favorite floor. You know, the Bible's influence in culture, whether it's law, medicine, science, art, music, literature, I mean, you name it, you can see the Bible has had an underpinning in so much of what we do and what we say and talk about, and we don't even realize it. And so our goal is that people will walk through that floor and just go, oh, wow, I never knew that. I never experienced that. I never thought about that coming from the Bible before. Even in manner of fashion, there's going to be a fashion section that the Bible has influenced fashion.
How has the Bible influenced fashion?
New York has had a fashion show about a year ago where the Bible's influence in fashion, so we're going to leverage that.
Huh.
And I can't answer your question. I'm not a fashion artist. So
sandals, I think.
Yeah. Exactly.
But this is a museum a bit like some of the other great museums of Washington. It's a massive enterprise.
It's a massive project. It's 430,000 square feet, so it's as big or bigger than the Smithsonian Institute. And so it's there among the family of museums, some of the greatest museums of the world. And so our goal is to meet that quality of museum expectation.
It's not everyone's sort of cup of tea to walk around and say, see a very ancient little vase from 3rd century BC. But this will have that type of thing, which is very interesting to lots of people. But also, as you say, these displays, which will be quite stunning, I think, in terms of illustrating the impact of the Bible on all sorts of ways.
Well, that's why I call it my favorite floor. You know, I'm trained to look at artifacts and things to a degree. But it's fun at the public level to look at how the Bible has influenced culture and society, art, music, etc. Also, we've partnered with other people, other organizations, museums, and libraries throughout the world. For instance, the Vatican Museum will be a partner with us. We've given them 10,000 square feet to display to open the vaults of the Vatican, if you will, and show things that people have maybe never seen before or the Vatican had an opportunity to display before, as well as the Vatican Library. Two different organizations, Vatican Museum, the Vatican Library, will have space for that as well. But it's anyone who loves the Bible, and so we've partnered with some Jewish partners in Israel, for instance, the Israeli Antiquity Authority, which has authority over all the artifacts and findings in the country of Israel. they have partnered with us to display the Dead Sea Scroll fragments and what they have and some of the artifacts that are really valuable treasures from the ancient world. They have a 10,000 square foot space. So in a sense, they have their own museum within our museum.
I read something about a biblical garden. There's going to be biblical gardens on the roof. Is that right?
What does that mean? Biblical garden and restaurant. So it's not merely a museum. There will be theaters and 500-seat ballroom, 550-foot-seat theater, as well as a garden so that figs and plants and lemons and things that are grown in the ancient world that are revealed in the Bible, you can actually see them grow and say, oh, that's what a fig tree looks like. I mean, people come from all parts of the world. Do you have fig trees in Australia?
We have kinds of fig trees, Moreton Bay figs.
Then you might know what a fig tree looks like, but a lot of people in the world don't have no idea what it looks like. And when they lose all their leaves in the wrong time of year, so it seems to us. It makes sense for some of Jesus' stories of coming to the fig tree, doing things in an unexpected season.
It's an incredible story, this Museum of the Bible. How did it come about? What's going on with this? Who's behind it? Why is it happening?
Sure. It came about through the Green family. They would buy an artifact just because they're interested in the Bible. And then it came to them that why should we buy these artifacts and keep them to ourselves when they should be displayed in public? And so they started thinking through the process of having a museum. One thing led to another, hired a fellow named Kerry Summers, who has this kind of background as well as a theme park background, to create a museum of museums, if you will. So it's not a static, just look at an old ancient vase, but it's very interactive that you actually engage the Bible. And then they continued to collect artifacts, and they thought, where should we put this museum? Should we put it in Dallas, Texas, or New York City, or really the center of museums in the States? That is, of course, Washington, D.C. And this land came up, and they managed to procure this land. And here we go, launching this incredible project, years in the making and years in the undertaking.
There have been one or two critics just raising concerns about the aims of the museum, whether it's trying to impose a kind of specific or maybe one-sided story of the Bible's transmission and impact. Is it possible for a museum like this to be objective? And what do you think of those concerns that people have raised?
Sure, those are legitimate concerns. Are we just portraying one story, one denomination, one prejudice of the Bible story? And our goal is not to do that. Just let the Bible speak for itself. All of its good points, some of its bad points, or some things that have been used for good in the world and some things that have not been used for good, and just tell the whole story, which is why we can partner with divergent groups like the Vatican, the Roman Catholic Church, and the Israeli Antiquity Authority, very divergent groups, as well as others throughout the world that we are inviting to come and join us, so that the story of just the Bible is told, so not some denominational bent or evangelistic message, but let the Bible just speak for itself.
If you've just joined us, you're listening to Life and Faith from the Center for Public Christianity, and we've been hearing about a massive new museum that's scheduled to open in 2017 in Washington, D.C. It's the Museum of the Bible. We've got in the studio David Trowbridge, who's the director of the collection. He's here with us. Welcome, David. And tell us a little bit about the collection. What's in it? I mean, I know you can't tell us everything that's in it, but give us a bit of a feel for the sorts of things people will encounter.
Well, the interest of the collection is to collect artifacts and items that tell the story of both the Jewish Bible and the Christian Bible. This is a rather important distinction because often we're mistaken as being just some kind of a Christian evangelical mission outreach or so. But the collection is really gathered under scholarly perspectives. It wants to be open to the public. We know through research that has been done, market research by Bible societies, that actually the people who know most about the Bible are people who are antagonistic. So we really, really want to provide an atmosphere where everyone can come in. So everything that you can see, you should be able to confirm independently. We also really want to tell the story, and the story of the Bible is not just only a good story. There are also many things there that we regret have happened in the past of this book.
People will encounter incredibly rare pieces of text, but also objects, won't they?
Mm-hmm. Our collection comprises cuneiform. That's before the writing was invented on papyrus or on leather or material like that. It was written in stone. One of the items that we're especially proud of that we bought last year is a slab of the Gilgamesh epos, literature, probably one of the oldest literature of humankind that is known, about 5,000 years old, what we have there in particular. And it's a story of Gilgamesh, and that includes, for example, the story of the Ark, you know, the big flood, and God rescuing a couple and then repopulating that, written at a time where Israel didn't even exist yet. And in a case like that, for example, we also want to show what scholars think about it. How do you explain these parallels? How do you explain the differences? We have Dead Sea Scrolls fragments there. Also replicas in this case. We don't like to show too many replicas, but to really give you an impression of the very, very large Isaiah scroll, for example. Interesting little part of the Jewish Bible is we have quite a collection of scrolls that went to China, to the Kaifeng community. But the second century common era, Jews started to emigrate also into mainland China, and I really mean mainland, not the coast. The coast has always been rather accessible. And they lived there, and the 13th century was a very thriving community, merchants going back and forth. And the synagogue there was closed around 1830, so rather recent. And they were so cut off from the rest of the world that they thought they were the last Jews alive in the world. And a British expedition brought back Torah scrolls and other like prayer books or so. And we are lucky enough to have several of those in our exhibition. And then it continues through the Latin Bible, which defined much of Western Christianity, and through that also Christianity as Europeans would know it, or North Americans or Australians.
Is there a particular item that gets you most excited?
By training, I'm a New Testament scholar, so the oldest fragments that we have of the New Testament is something that fascinates me. For example, we have the oldest fragment known about John 8. Now, I'm not sure everyone gets excited about that, but we're especially fascinated if there are variants, which means the text is not quite what we're reading today in our Bibles. That particular example in John 8 has the story of Jesus and adulterous woman. So if you read the Bible for several decades, it may have been in your Bible when you were a young person, but it's not in your Bible anymore. It moved into the footnotes or has brackets because the oldest manuscripts that have been discovered don't have this story. And then when it enters it in different places. We have manuscripts where it's Matthew or in Luke or different places in John. But the King James just happened to have it there at the beginning of chapter 8. So even a little scrap about a text like that will give you an insight on the earliest history of this text.
What's your vision then for the museum? How do you see it looking? What are you hoping for people as they come across this?
The goal is to engage people with the Bible. And I think that's true for other museums as well. I mean, you walk in there, let's say it's a car museum or a Porsche museum or so, you want to learn something, you want to be engaged, but you don't necessarily have to drive a Porsche in order to go there. The American situation with separating so strictly between state and church has had as a result that the education and public school system does not really talk very much about the Bible. They're too afraid to get into trouble. But as a museum, you can do that. You can provide the background information that in other countries probably would be much easier accessible than, ironically, than in the U.S. But we also think about it globally. This is not just this one building in Washington, D.C., but we do international exhibits. So we have a project running now in Africa. I just came from a trip through India to look at the early history, the early missionaries there, and what is still available in archives. And after here, I will leave for Cuba, where at the end of the week we're opening an exhibit in Santiago de Cuba, which is something that doesn't happen very often, that an American organization would be invited to do something like that.
I wonder whether an exhibit might make its way to Australia eventually. We hope so.
Yes, of course, we hope so as well. And that's also one of the purposes for this trip, to just to get to know each other and see what our partners might be like and how we can help out.
We will keep our eye on that. And for people interested in this, you can look up some information on the net. You can go to museumofthebible.org. We'd recommend people do that. So good to have you in. Thanks so much for coming.
Well, thank you for having me.
And thank you, Simon, Natasha.
You've been listening to Life and Faith, and we've been speaking today with Alan Quine and David Trowbridge from the Museum of the Bible.
If you enjoyed this episode, then why don't you subscribe to our podcast on iTunes? You can just type Centre for Public Christianity in the search box to find us. And while you're there, let us know what you think by leaving us a rating or review.
Next week, Alyssa Wilkinson, film and culture critic for Vox.com.
So dystopia is sort of the more woke version of utopia. It's where we look at it and say, oh, utopia was only utopia for whoever created the utopia. Dystopia, though, is a pessimistic version of the future. And it's where we're kind of working out our biggest anxieties as a culture. Like, for instance, does the human race deserve to continue?